Want to be more media literate?
It's led to lies without repercussions, slander, hoaxes, misinformation, all sorts of craziness that's online. Should the platforms be liable for that?
KMOX News wants to help you make sense of the information you consume. You spend more screen time than sleep time. Yeah, you do. Join me, Megan Lynch, and media literacy expert Julie Smith as we ask, what the media, in our new podcast. Find it on KMOX.com under the podcast page or wherever you get your podcasts.
The news cycle is incredible. Well, it's not 24 hours anymore. It's 10 minutes.
If we hope to survive in this digital age, we have to think critically about the messages we consume. Someone created those messages for a reason. Let's find out why. Sometimes we just have to ask, what the media? I'm Megan Lynch, host and reporter at Legacy 50,000 Watt AM radio station KMOX in St. Louis, Missouri. In my three decades as a journalist, I've had the honor of receiving a number of awards for my work, including one I'm most proud of, a National Edward R. Murrow Award. I'm joined by Julie Smith, author of Master the Media, How Teaching Media Literacy Can Save Our Plugged-In World. As an instructor and public speaker, Julie teaches how to dissect what you see and hear so you can be a savvy digital consumer. In this episode, info snacking. Julie, I remember when USA Today first came on the scene.
McPaper.
Yeah, and for journalists, this was going to be the worst thing in the world because instead of having, you know, all of those paragraphs, you had a story summarized in maybe three or four paragraphs.
With a colored chart.
That was blasphemy.
Photos.
It was blasphemy.
It was snacking.
Yeah.
Snacking at its best.
It was going to ruin journalism. I mean, I distinctly remember this.
And even the vending machines of the USA Today were made to look like televisions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it was a newspaper for television watchers, essentially.
Yeah. And the thought was that we were going to dumb down America. Instead of the thought being, we're going to give them a little bit quicker information for those that don't want to pour through a two-page article.
Or that we're making information accessible to more people who can't read.
We're talking about info snacking, how we are getting our information throughout the day. But when the term first came out, Juliet, actually meant something a little bit different than how we refer to it now.
So when it came out, it originally meant that it was time spent at work doing non-work stuff online. Like when you were at work, maybe checking your personal email or checking the sports scores or et cetera.
So instead of having a lunch break, you were stealing a little snack time.
Stealing time. Yeah, stealing snack time from the employer. Well, then it also emerged into jumping online throughout the day. So, you know, like we grab our phones and maybe check things several times throughout the day. But now the term actually refers to our tendency to only read headlines and photo captions so that we're getting the snack of the information, but very rarely the entire meal. That's significant because in many cases, the headline doesn't even match the article. And clickbait headlines are so popular, we click on things that really have no value whatsoever. 8 out of 10 people read the headlines of an article. Only 2 of 10 will read the article.
I can believe it.
Yeah.
And guilty as charged.
Yes, same.
Even as we've been sitting here in the studio, how many times have I looked at my phone because some little alert has come up on my phone?
Well, but in your defense, you're a news reporter. So if something is going on, you need to know about it.
That's true. But I know hundreds of other people that do the exact same thing.
Are you telling me that when someone retweets me, it's not important?
Why do we have this need, or how has this developed that we are satisfied with just a little bit?
I think it's because we have so much information to process, we cannot process all of it at once. In 2014, there was a study that we actually consume 34 gigabytes a day. That's enough to fill a laptop in a few days. And that was, what, 7 years ago? So I can't even imagine what that data amount would be up to today. There's this man from the University College in London, Professor Levy. He says it takes a lot of energy to run the human brain. And if we are consuming information every waking minute, which essentially we are, right, it's a lot to process. So if we can get by mentally with just reading a headline, why not? But the problem is that in many cases, we're missing the context, right?
Yes. And I mean, how many times have you heard people open up a conversation did you hear about such and such? And then it turns out people don't really know much about it.
Nothing.
Because they just...
They've just been snacking.
Yes.
So, okay, here's some interesting data. 70% of Americans share articles based on the headline alone. Yeah, and the headline doesn't always match the article. But here's something funny. There's a satirical website called The Science Post. They shared a headline, and the headline was, and this is ironic, 70% of Facebook users only read headlines before commenting. That's the headline that they posted on their Facebook group. If you clicked on the headline, it went to a link where it was just in Latin. Okay, so there was actually no article. It was shared 46,000 times. So they proved their own point.
That people didn't even bother to even click through.
No. Or if they did, they would have seen that it was Latin. And maybe some people shared it ironically. But here's another example. There's a woman that writes for Upworthy, that website. Her name's Anne Renault. She posted a piece on Facebook about domestic terrorism being mainly white supremacists. And the link to that article led to a 404 error on purpose. There were 2,000 comments on that article. So people were commenting on the headline alone, even though if you clicked on it, it took you to a 404 error page. And I think that's fascinating. It almost makes me want to try it with my students.
Sociology experiment. I have to admit, I find that sometimes with tweets I have sent out from news stories that we have done here, mm-hmm. and someone will respond to me, and I've literally responded to them, did you read the article?
And their
crickets.
Response, and their response is?
Crickets.
Crickets, which is code for no.
Now, a Media Minute with Megan Lynch.
What's in your online diet? Media literacy expert Julie Smith tells us why it matters.
Have you ever been so inundated with information that it's almost impossible to determine what is real, meaningful, or valid, that it's just too much to process? You may be suffering from information overload, sometimes called infogestion or even infobesity. Whatever you call it, it can be confusing, frustrating, and exhausting. Research says we can pay attention to maybe 3 or 4 things at once, but our minds might feel like a browser with 80 tabs open. So what do? Some experts suggest mentally putting information aside, which sounds nearly impossible in today's world. Still others suggest setting up multiple filters, not just with our email accounts, but with our brains as well. Learning to skim might be a way to avoid information overload, but even then we might miss details or the context of a story. Other advice includes taking many breaks or even daydreaming, perhaps dreaming of the day when the information didn't require quite so much processing.
We talk about info snacking in our new podcast, What the Media. You can find it at KMOX.com and on the Odyssey app.
Now, a Media Minute with Megan Lynch.
We get messages from radio, TV, newspapers, social media, even billboards. Julie Smith teaches media literacy.
The struggle now, I think, with media literacy is that we're swimming in this ocean of messages that we don't even really notice anymore. And we're so surrounded by it, we're less likely to really analyze it because it's just a normal part of life. But I don't think we realize the effect it has on us, about how it makes us feel, how it helps us define ourselves, how it helps us define others that we may not meet in person. There's just so much influence that the whole institution has that I really think we should be talking about it and analyzing it more.
Smith says some of the questions to ask about media messages: who's the sender? What's their motive? How does it make you feel? Who profits from the message? To learn more, check out our podcast, What the Media, on Apple, Google, Stitcher, and at KMOX.com.
Now, a Media Minute with Megan Lynch.
Educators knew return to in-person learning would bring challenges after the pandemic, but they weren't expecting the types of challenges that go viral.
Social media is becoming an influence that we should have expected but haven't been prepared for.
Dr. Kevin Martin is principal at Parkway Northeast Middle School.
What used to be a trend in one school is now a trend across an entire country or world, and so what we might think is just a funny video quickly turns into every single kid wanting to be like that, to become viral.
Martin says kids believe that's how they'll become popular and well-liked among their peers, and that led to destruction of property and vandalism at schools across the country.
I believe this generation is going to have class action lawsuits against social media companies, like my parents did against cigarette companies, that we knew of the harm that it causes people, but yet we did not provide proper warning.
Educators are trying to use social media to their advantage, joining online groups to discuss viral trends and using the same platforms as their students to better understand what kids are experiencing. If you want a better understanding of how social media work, listen to our podcast, What the Media. You can find it on KMOX.com, Apple Podcasts, and the Odyssey app.
Now, a Media Minute with Megan Lynch.
You may feel like you're being reeled in by headlines you see online. Media literacy expert Julie Smith tells us that's by design.
Here's a list of 10 things about clickbait, and try not to gasp when you hear number 7. That's a classic formula for a clickbait headline, along with some of these goodies. You won't believe what happened next, or if you're over 50, you should read this, or the truth about this organization may shock you. Clickbait headlines are sensationalized and written specifically to grab our attention and generate traffic to a particular website. That's how the sites can make more money from their advertisers. They're not bad. In fact, sometimes they can be downright entertaining, but it's wise to know their formulas. They're easily found in chum buckets, which is the name for those irresistible square little ads at the very bottom of many websites. Why are they called chum buckets? Well, because we are the sharks, and those headlines are very easy to sink our teeth into.
Want to learn more about the media you consume? Subscribe to the What the Media podcast, available on Apple, Google, Stitcher, and at KMOX.com.
Joining us in studio is Julie Smith, Webster University professor, joining us for the Press Box. She is the author of Master the Media, How Teaching Media Literacy Can Save Our Plugged-In World. And because of this terrible shooting that occurred, and you heard on KMOX News, I think 7 people, we wondered what constitutes a mass shooting. And for me, that is an issue of media literacy, because what you hear from one media may vary to the next.
Well, and word choice matters.
Right.
Word choice matters very much. So I think what we need to do is ask, what makes something newsworthy in general? So right. How would you all define what makes something newsworthy?
Right.
That's a good question. Let's do that. Let's answer that.
Yeah, right, let's do it.
Numbers, I think numbers often matter. And sad to say, when it comes to shootings, one is maybe not, but it depends even on what the one is. Was it a child?
You know,
was it in a public place, or is it 10? Reporters determine one of those things.
Right, because there is one of the issues is there's no standard definition for what constitutes a mass shooting. Mm-hmm. So like CBS and Time Magazine, Associated Press, et cetera, will say that it's a shooting that involves 4 or more people, and not any of them necessarily need to be killed. So what happened in St. Louis last night, by that definition, is a mass shooting. Mm-hmm. But no one is referring to it as a mass shooting. And I think that's really, really interesting, because even the Post-Dispatch doesn't have it on its front banner of the website today. The second story under trending is that story about the shooting. NBC is calling it fatal shooting in St. Louis. Kansas City Star, St. Louis shooting. New York Daily News, St. Louis shooting. CNN, St. Louis shooting. No one is referring to it as a mass shooting, and I think that's really interesting.
Is it a race thing? If it was a white person shooting that many people, would it then be, you know what I mean?
And that's a very fair question. There was research done at the University of Chicago a couple years ago that said blacks killed in black neighborhoods get about half the coverage of whites killed in white neighborhoods.
Which I don't think is really, you have a different sense of that. You're saying that if a white person did it, would we call it a mass shooting, because generally white people are involved in mass shootings?
Right, like if they walk into a former employer or something like that,
yeah,
that's when it seems like it's called. This is in a neighborhood. We don't know the background of the actual incident in this case.
We don't know, but you see the difference there. You're saying that
the perpetrators
are white, and they are in these mass shootings we've reported on. But you're asking, is it because they are black? We assume. Are we not calling it a mass shooting?
That is the question.
And
yes.
And then you say that black shootings in black neighborhoods don't even get the kind of coverage.
That's absolutely true. Absolutely true. In fact, in many cases, the names aren't mentioned of the victims. And what I think is really interesting in this research from the University of Chicago says that newsworthy stories, so shootings that get a ton of news coverage, typically break our assumptions that a place is safe. So shootings that take place in a church or a school or a mall or some public place will get more coverage because it's not as unusual as like a domestic disturbance, which apparently is what happened this morning in Jefferson County.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So there's a lot involved. But what I want to challenge you all to do is think about if this shooting had occurred in O'Fallon, Illinois, or O'Fallon, Missouri, at a strip mall, mm-hmm. how would the coverage be different?
Yeah, it would be different.
It'd be very different. Yeah. If seven people were shot, like at Plaza Frontenac, can you imagine? The network the network news anchors would be in town. Anderson Cooper would be here. There would be three or four solid days of coverage. The word mass shooting would definitely be used.
And we'd know the names.
We'd know their names. There'd be interviews with friends and family members, right? We'd probably have cameras at the funeral, or at least across the street from the funeral. There'd be stories about how the community was coming together after this tragedy. We won't get that in North St. Louis.
Do we know why? Do you have an assumption?
I can tell you.
Go, Carol.
You're our guest. No, you're our guest. I've put on my former news anchor hat and talk about that.
Okay, and this is depressing to talk about, but one of the characteristics of news coverage is novelty. You know, William Randolph Hearst said the editor doesn't care for facts, he cares for novelty, something that's new and unusual.
Wow.
And sadly, shootings in North St. Louis are not unusual enough to garner the attention I think that they deserve.
And the thing that even frustrates me about that is then when we do talk about the crime in a black community, we talk about it in a way that's very different. We don't talk about the coming together. We don't know the names of the victims.
Right.
We don't talk about it in a way that gives humanity to the people, because there's so much of the crime there. So we talk about it as a problem and not a tragedy. Does that make sense to me? Other than when children are killed.
Let me throw this out here as an argument. Could that be a blessing and a curse? So imagine every single day on this show, if we said shooting in North St. Louis, shooting in North St. Louis every single day, because that's what we encounter every single day in St. Louis. That would give us a certain impression of St. Louis that necessarily you don't want to try to perpetrate. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be the ones out there try to paint the wrong narrative or picture, even though it is the truth in what is being reported.
So it's depressing.
Yeah, and it's very depressing. Mm-hmm, so it can kind of be a blessing and a curse at the same time.
And the curse, I think, comes in the long-term effects of that, because are we essentially, by the attention that we pay, are we essentially saying that some people are more valuable than others? That some lives are expendable and some are not?
And to that, can I say that you recall some years ago, there was controversy that, and when I say the media, I hate to say that phrase, but that if the missing girl was blonde, then the coverage was very different than if the missing girl, you didn't even get coverage.
Mm. Right.
If the missing girl was black or brown, you didn't even get. So that the media has been accused of its own discrimination, I guess. I don't know. I don't want to.
It can be a racial issue. I also think it's a socioeconomic issue in many cases.
Yeah.
And also, some part that you forget about, too, and when you don't talk about some of these crimes, is that when you're a victim, or maybe you're a family member or a friend of a victim, someone that was shot, someone that saw a family member die, whatever it is, their story goes unheard. And it seems like they never get closure, because it feels like no one cared about their loved one. It's terrible for the victim.
Do you remember what Rocky Madden had to say to us when he was on last week? That one of the things that he wouldn't miss, and I'm saying those words, was that going to talk to the victims' families. You know, saying, you know, how do you feel? You know,
that's exactly why I never got into news. I couldn't do it. I couldn't be that guy, you know. How's it feel that the tornado ripped out the trailer park?
No, I always feel respect for people who say, I don't want to talk about that now.
Yeah, right. You know? Yeah,
and at the same time, what you say, Ryan, is very relevant. That if we, there's something to be said to not intrude in that tragic time, but then we do it when the dad's a doctor, right?
But it's also a great story. It can be a compelling story.
Right.
NewsGuard rates websites for credibility and transparency. The organization says of the more than 6,000 news and information sites it tracks, roughly 500 have published COVID misinformation.
I think we're trying to reach the news consumer that just simply doesn't recognize and can't recognize the difference between what is a credible news source and what is one of these spreaders of misinformation, because these days they can look so similar.
John Gregory is a journalist and researcher for NewsGuard.
They can have names that sound like legitimate news sources. They can sound like you know, almost a government agency, like in the case of the National Vaccine Information Center, who would recognize that off the bat as an anti-vaccine group.
Gregory says many of the sites flagged for COVID misinformation have a history of omitting information and publicizing false claims and hoaxes. He points out many of these sites get significant online traffic and revenue from unsuspecting advertisers.
Advertisers themselves, they are not intending to buy and pay for their brands to be promoted on online misinformation and disinformation. They simply work with programmatic advertisers who then place their ads on those websites.
Gregory adds some of the sites that post misinformation don't even share who owns or operates them. Megan Lynch, KMOX News. If we hope to survive in this digital age, we have to think critically about the messages we consume. Someone created those messages for a reason. Let's find out why. Sometimes we just have to ask, what the media? I'm Megan Lynch, and Edward R. Murrow and Gracie Award winner with Legacy Radio Station KMOX in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm joined by Julie Smith, author, instructor, public speaker, and our guide for how to be a savvy media consumer. In the first season of our podcast, we focused on dissecting messages. This season, transparency from the mouths of the content creators.
Verification is the fundamental part of what we do.
In this episode, show your work.
We tell them where we got it. We put names on it. We put online, we can put documents, we can put video.
We go to the newsroom of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, an award-winning daily newspaper founded by Joseph Pulitzer himself. It's gone beyond newsprint to an online presence.
We're in the business of verifying information. We're not just throwing stuff out there.
The man responsible for oversight of the Post-Dispatch and its digital portal, sdltoday.com, is editor Gilbert Bylone.
Our mission is to serve our local community with solid, verified information that people can use in their lives and use to make decisions about their own lives, how they vote, how they participate in schools. The idea is that quality information that people want, with a local emphasis. Clearly, we cover news besides local news, but our staff here in St. Louis is primarily focused on our local communities, and that's the focus that we believe is important because there's a lot of other media covering other things. We focus on the St. Louis metro area.
So there are countless stories that happen every day. Walk us through what a meeting is like when you all decide what stories go on the front page.
Well, there's a whole range of subjects. I think one is what we consider to be public interest of importance. Is there impact on people's lives? Is it have something? Sometimes it could be just a really good, interesting story. Today we wrote about the heat at the Cardinals game. That was not the only thing. But what are people talking about? We try to tap into what people are interested in. But a lot of, particularly with print, because online's a different animal. There's a lot more points of entry than there is on the front page. But on the front page, we want to have a good local mix of news and information that's pertinent that day. Does it impact people is a real big part of that. Or people interested in this. There's a good story behind it. It's a good profile. Clearly, when you're doing things like COVID and crime and other, there's a public interest with that. But sometimes it's just a good local story of people doing good things or creating. We have today the new F-15 that Boeing's creating, what's creating jobs. So that's of local interest. It's on our front page. We also have other stories about politics and courts. So
how do you decide when you look at your newsroom and you look at those desks out there behind us, who's going to be covering a certain story?
Well, a lot of it is we have it organized. We call them beats in our business. You could be covering the police beat or the crime beat or city hall or county council, politics. We have people in Jeff City covering the state legislature and government. So they're more beat-oriented. Then we have others who are more generalist. They could be covering business news. They could be covering neighborhood news. They could be floating, doing different things. So our newsroom's not as big as it used to be, so there's more fluidity. So there are people, for example, our food writer, Dan Neiman, sometimes works weekends. He covered a police shooting because we're more fluid with what we do, but that's not his normal job. So what we do is we try to make sure we have people available for the stories that break, you know, the breaking news, but also we try to find ways to get what we call enterprise, stories of depth that take more time, digging out data and graphics and information like that. So it's always a mix. It's depends on the day. Some days are busier than others, but we're always looking at, do we have a good mix of what we're trying to do so we're not just covering one topic or one type of news.
So you mentioned breaking news, and yet your physical paper has to be put to bed at night. So explain to our listeners what it means to, quote, put the paper to bed and what time that usually happens.
Well, print is part of what we do, but, you know, we spend a lot of time, like today, online. We have a lot of things going on, so that's a big part of it. But for print, our late deadline is 12:30. But typically we have most of it done by 11. Sports is usually our later things, with whether it's the Cardinals or the Blues, whoever's playing. But much of the news part will be done by about 11 o'clock. And so we have to make sure we meet those deadlines. Online is a whole different animal. We can update through the night, in the morning, all day, weekends, nights. Very different animal as far as being, you know, pertinent and urgent. And that's a big part of what we do. I think sometimes people think of newspapers and you think only the print. That is a significant part of what we do, but it's far more than that now. We do multimedia, we have video, we have podcasts, we have all kinds of things that we do that are only digital that don't appear in print, because in that form, the stories may be similar, but we can do a lot more online because the space is unlimited. We can do things like a video that we can't do in a printed paper. So.
And you can do breaking news in the morning, even though the paper doesn't come out until the following day. So even though you put the paper to bed, the website never sleeps, right?
Pretty much. I mean, probably the deep, deep nights, maybe a little bit, but it's not for very long. And plus, we have help from our corporate brethren that also helps us for big breaking stories that are of national, international news. So we try to be a complete website. We focus on local here, but we also want to make sure that people are well informed about national and international news because we're a metro newspaper.
Gilbert, I remember when our station first got a website and we all kind of rolled our eyes and we thought, well, we'll see how long this lasts. You know, now, of course, it's integral to what we do and how we reach our listeners and now just a new generation of people that are coming to only maybe the digital side. Do you see that for yourself here in the newspaper industry, that they're really starting to balance themselves out, or even maybe, you know, digital is surpassing some of the print side?
I think as far as our efforts, digital is actually surpassing, because you got to remember, these platforms are shared. So that story that you might see online at 3 o'clock could be also in your printed paper, may not be the exact same version. It may be shorter, could be longer, other things. So we're just worried about creating that content. Then we worry about how do we put it up. We want to get it up as quickly as we can. In some cases, we can add a lot of different elements to a digital format that we can't in print. So digital subscriptions are a really big part of the newspaper, and certainly here. People are subscribing. That means, and many of them are just digital subscribers. They don't get that print edition for various reasons. Some of it, they don't want it. It's easier for them. They can read it on their phone and their iPad. And that's a growing part of our audience. People are used to streaming now. People are used to subscribing to all these different services. And one of those can be the newspaper if you want local news, because we have the biggest newsroom. We think we provide the most qualitative news across everything. News, features, sports, everything that we do is all locally based. And so we believe that there's value with that. But our industry's changing. It's a dramatic change, probably in the last 5 years. But really, if you go back when the internet started, it really began that process.
So do you feel like the Post is not completely a newspaper anymore, but more of a content-generating enterprise?
Oh, yes. It's a content, it's a media company. Mm-hmm. And we do things on the business side that are different from just doing selling the newspaper, as far as, you know, Amplified Digital and other things that are happening. So it's a much bigger company than that. I think what we're trying to do is serve people where they are. And people are used, they're mobile, they're out, they want things immediate. They want things quickly. They're used to social media. So that's a big part of how we change. That's how it helps us get our information out quickly. But it's not all we do. But we have to be reactive to that, whether people are on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, wherever they might be, people get news in different ways. And we want to make sure we're part of that because it's evolving and it'll continue to evolve. Not all of them are going to be what we consider our traditional newspaper readers, but those are the ones that we really do like because they're the ones who have been reading us for many years, and we're going to continue to serve them. We're not going to stop doing that. It's just a different format.
Julie once asked me when we were talking about what we do in the radio newsroom, how many people would review a story that I do, for example, before it might go on the air. So I'm going to ask you that. When it comes to the stories that go both in print and online, what's that process for vetting that information, writing those headlines, and making sure it's all accurate?
Well, verification is the fundamental part of what we do. And I think sometimes, whether you want to call it legacy media or mainstream media, including KMOX and news stations in town, we're in the business of verifying information. We're not just throwing stuff out there. I think there's, because media is a very, very large term now, whether it's talk radio or social media or bloggers or people who are podcasting, it's very different from when I broke in the business.